Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com, and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe, and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening. We're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent investment performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker, Bremont. So, Nick, welcome back to the second part of this discussion on the world of blockchain and cryptocurrencies. In this part, we're going to discuss the debasement and future of money, digital transacting, inflation, crypto crime, China and its state-controlled digital currency, the issue of personal freedoms, and government regulation. So let's continue.
An interesting fact that I learned last year was that 23.6% of all US dollars ever created in the history of the United States were printed in the past 18 months. And so when you start to hear the rumblings about what the inflation schedule is, and especially when the agencies that are reporting on that, I'm getting a little curious, because to me, the real inflation schedule is the increase in the monetary supply, not what they talk about. So I'm particularly concerned about that, because at the end of the day, regular people don't understand that the money that they hold in their bank accounts is no longer helping them earn wealth or protect their savings or their wealth. That force alone is dramatically concerning. You know, we're not out of the woods in terms of the historical context of our era. There's still a lot of geopolitical instability. The health crisis is far from over. We have midterm elections in the United States, a presidential transition in France. You've got a new leader coming into Germany, and there has still been no major, I would say, accountability on this whole pandemic around what has really happened and who knew what when. And I think there's still some big consequences to shake out from all that.
There's a whole separate podcast on the loss of purchasing power of these major currencies. I think the numbers I most recently saw was over the last 100 years, the US dollar has lost 99% of its purchasing power. But just staying with regulation, SEC Chairman Gary Gensler announced a few months ago that the SEC will come up with a regulatory framework for crypto next year. Is that what's really needed to give the stamp of approval?
So the answer there is it kind of depends. We're still waiting to see what type of regulatory approval and what that means. I think it's concerning when politicians pick winners and losers in markets, especially when they're regulating things they don't really understand, whether it's female health issues or digital currencies or weapon systems, agricultural processes. We should err on the side of innovation and make sure that our politicians are very, very well informed on the work that they're governing on. Most recently, this past weekend, the US infrastructure bill in Washington, D.C. was literally held up over specifically crypto amendments. And that is a pretty wild change of events if you really consider what that means. The largest infrastructure package in the history of the United States was being held up because of disagreements on how to cultivate, nurture, and continue to invest in financial innovation while trying to mitigate some of the concerns and risks that are very valid to protect consumers from the things that we want to protect them from, whether that's fraud or financial crime. My view is we need to continue to educate our policymakers who still frequently were born in an era where they didn't necessarily actually grow up with the technologies, but are starting to regulate them. That has a lot of adverse consequences because if the United States scares away the financial innovation happening in this sector, it will go abroad and it will innovate somewhere else. We've got one chance here, from my perspective, to tool a better form of money. That's in everybody's interest. If it's easier for people to trade and exchange wealth, we will experience greater prosperity. We will build better tools. We will build life-saving innovations, and we will raise the standard of living for everyone that peacefully engages in commerce. But if we make commerce more difficult, if we continue to exclude people from participating in the economy, and we don't innovate our form of money to make it better for the age of the internet, then we will have adverse consequences. And it's difficult to predict what all those would be, but in an era where we're printing too much money, inflation is apparently being underreported for sure. I'm pretty concerned about that.
So just staying with the future of money, I was intrigued because a few months back we had Clive Vacher, who is the CEO of De La Rue. They print banknotes around the world, and he was making the observation that you have over 2 billion people who are unbanked in the world, and that actually the death of the banknote is way too premature in people's mind. What's your view of money in 10 years' time?
So partially this is a generational thing. I like to collect coins when I was a kid, and then I like to collect game cards, and then I like to collect virtual tokens as well. And so I do think that cash, as we know it today, will cease to exist within the next 10 to 15 to 20 years. I don't know if it'll be gone within 10 years. It's certainly being phased out the most advanced economies today for a variety of reasons. One, it's a pain in the butt to mint. It's actually quite dirty. And in the era of a health crisis, having people handling and moving money and transmitting viruses is not clever. And then on top of that, governments have a serious interest in surveilling economic activity. And so putting that aside, because I think there are other risks with having a surveilled form of money, because I think there are strong reasons why people should have privacy in their economic transactions, there's a lot of trend toward digital contactless payments, et cetera. So most young adults won't ever probably handle cash by the end of the next decade. And so it'll take a little while to phase itself out in that way. You can expect cash to still be prevalent, I think, especially in emerging markets where people just have no trust in their institutions whatsoever. What's interesting in those markets, though, is you also see the lack of trust in institutions has led to faster adoption of digital forms of payments and money. So in Kenya, in Nigeria, the use of digital payments far exceeds the use of cash transactions now. And that occurred very, very quickly. We'll see. I don't think you'll see much cash. I think it'll be collector's items. People will look fondly on the faces of old bygone leaders, and they'll go, well, that was so funny that you guys used to kill trees and print pictures of old political figures. You couldn't even send that money over the internet? That doesn't make any sense. Why do you guys use those things? And also, why did you guys print so much of this stuff? It became worthless. That was pretty foolish of you. And then we'll be like, yeah, we should have known better. We didn't follow our own history.
No, look, I get it. I think the answer is time frame. And I think, like we all thought, tobacco companies might sort of, you know, disappear, and they proved to be much more permanent. It's maybe just a longer journey for a world of 7.5 billion people. But talking about your company, blockchain.com, it is clearly in a very central position to the growth of this market. How would you like to see it develop over the next decade?
There are two things that I'm really concentrated on. We want to build an alternative financial system for the internet that empowers anyone in the world to control their money so that basically we can wrap the planet in an economic capability that enables people to send, receive, secure, trade, and exchange digital forms of wealth. And if we can get 1 billion people doing that, I know that I will have left this world in a slightly better place than I inherited it. And I honestly feel that especially the younger generations are facing off against institutions and momentum in an economy that isn't really in their favor. If you do the things you were said you were supposed to do, get a job, go to college, pay for everything, take on the debt you need to get that degree, go into work for some large corporation, save more money than you earn. If you do those things today, you are horrifically in debt. Your savings are actually being devalued by an economic system that is extracting your value over the long term. And you are not preparing for an economy that is going to become vastly more global, vastly more digital. And this remote work first thing that everyone's so excited about actually means hire anywhere. And so there's huge structural changes occurring in the macro economy all simultaneously. And being able to adapt to that is extraordinarily important. And so in short, the mission at blockchain.com is to facilitate a world where anyone can have better control over the tools they use to manage their wealth and exchange that wealth with anybody else they want to. The other thing I'm passionate about, though, is supporting entrepreneurship. Basically, we're going to need a way more diverse generation of wealth creators than we've ever had to build the tools and the services and to clothe and feed us. The two things I'm concentrated on in my career are, one, reinventing people's relationship with money. And at blockchain.com, we have a really strong shot at building what I would describe as a world-changing company to enable more people to have control over their wealth. I concentrate a lot on entrepreneurship initiatives so that we can get more young adults practicing building companies, earning wealth as opposed to being wage employees, and hopefully building the companies that'll navigate the challenges of the future. And all the big challenges we do have are also incredible opportunities for the next generation to work on climate change issues, to work on racial inequality issues, to work on access to financial services, financial literacy, and political reform too. We have a significant lack of leadership in the world and governance, in a lot of ways, I think, is not representing the speed of technological change. And we need more leaders in the world that are tooled in the language and vocabulary of this technological inadequacy that we are facing off against.
So let's talk about crime. In May of this year, the FT had a very interesting article, The Rise of the Crypto Laundries. I quote, "The ability to hold cryptocurrencies without divulging your identity has made them increasingly attractive to criminals, particularly to hackers who demand ransoms. And last year, at least $350 million was paid out to hacker gangs." Now, what I don't understand is that since I thought each step was discoverable through the blockchain ledger, how come we've got this ability for criminals to hide?
Every single time a transaction is made on a digital currency network, that transaction is written into a blockchain and is publicly studyable. When an illicit actor, let's say a hacker in a country like North Korea, which has now been studied by many cyber criminal firms to be very active in stealing people's digital currencies, that transaction is publicly viewable. We know that it happened, and we can see that it has gone to a destination address that is associated with fraud or criminal activity. And so these addresses get tagged. Now, once money is stolen, it is extraordinarily difficult to get back unless those bad actors try to move those funds through a custodial exchange. So earlier this year, someone held ransom one of the oil pipelines in the United States. They paid a fee, a ransom, to unlock access to their back-end servers. And when those guys tried to cash out, the FBI was able to seize those funds and prevent them from basically pulling the money back into what I would call the atomic economy. So we've got sort of a dual challenge, which is, yes, there's a high degree of transparency. So when bad things happen, we can actually monitor them and we can trace the flow of funds, but we can't necessarily catch the bad actors if they're in one jurisdictions that are not receptive to Western, especially Western law enforcement initiatives, or two, if they're keeping things digitally, it's very, very difficult to track them down because they're not going into a venue where we can attach an identity to them or freeze their funds. And so just like in the normal economy, bad guys use cash to perform all kinds of illicit activity. And then HSBC, I think last year, paid record fines for money laundering moving through their systems. It's not necessarily explicitly the system's design or flaws that are the fault here. It's also how you police it. And so there are now many major compliance firms that do nothing but concentrate on tracking these stolen illicit funds. And they sit and wait patiently until the bad actors move those funds into a venue where we can then coordinate, you know, an enforcement action against that venue. But if those venues are in places like North Korea, it's extraordinarily difficult to enforce against.
So Neil Ferguson, the professor who you know and I know, and he was on our show last year and obviously wrote The Ascent of Money, made the observation on this podcast that for him, Bitcoin was an option on digital gold. But I had an exchange with him a couple of weeks ago, and his question was, what's the government regulation you most fear?
I think he's right. So Bitcoin is the first one to pioneer a whole bunch of new concepts, vocabulary, technological innovation in the blockchain. And it wrote a bunch of assumptions, meaning the currency supply, the inflation schedule, the use proof of work as a mining algorithm to distribute newly minted coins. And so far, that's proven to find a certain product market fit. Is it possible that there's some 15, 16-year-old savant in, I don't know, France or Nigeria or somewhere else that's dreaming up some new system that has better capabilities, more transactional throughput, can distribute itself more globally and use less energy to provide the same degree of computational security? It's very possible. And when that happens, it's possible too that the social brain trust of one of these networks will adopt something else even more quickly. And so I don't think we should be afraid of innovation or changes. And Neil's not incorrect in saying that it's possible that an even better form of digital currency will come along. I think it's actually inevitable. In terms of a regulation or one thing that would probably be most damaging, in terms of government enforcement, it's been a decade since the first network launched. And in that decade, we've seen every sort of attack thrown at these networks, whether it was financial regulation, intrusion by foreign actors, competition. They're quite resilient by design. I don't think it's very feasible for a government to actually make these things illegal, but censorship on a grand scale would be concerning. And we already see what that looks like in China. The only way you can turn off cryptocurrency is by censoring the internet or turning the internet off. And that is an unlikely path, I think, in a pluralistic society that values freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and has also enshrined, at least in the US, that money is also freedom of expression and freedom of speech. And so, and long story short, there are now actually digital currencies that are what are called stable coins and are actually just fiat tokens of dollars or tokenized pounds or tokenized euros. So even if you are hardcore into loving your pounds and your euros and your dollars, you can actually get all of the features of digital currency, meaning instantly sendable over the internet, basically for free, transactional capabilities globally, and settlement with a high degree of certainty, and you get no volatility because you're using dollars, pounds, or euros. You can use stable coins, and those stable coins are actually settling and clearing on these public ledger blockchains. So there are now stable coins issued on the Bitcoin network. There are stable coins issued on the Ethereum protocol, on the Polkadot protocol, and on the Algorand protocol. Long story short, these technological systems are actually just gobbling up all forms of property rights, whether that's cash, assets, options, derivatives, equity, and people are using these global transactional networks to instantly settle and clear these property rights. And that is a huge change. And so because that's already happened, I don't think it's likely that any government would actually find a way to kill this without killing the internet. And in doing that, they'd be betraying probably the most important growth engine that we have to bank our economies on for the future.
So you've just touched on something that is really important, which is about personal freedoms and government's interventions. In China, I think I'm right in saying they are in the process of shutting down 90% of Bitcoin mining, and they are launching their own digital yuan. If I get it right, it's Fanuzian Jin from the Center for a New American Security in Washington said it's not just a technical experiment, it's a giant leap for the Communist Party's control and influence in Chinese society. Now, Western governments, in creating maybe their own versions of digital currencies, are they not encroaching on individuals' freedoms as well?
I think it's a valid question. Observing what's happening in China, it's important to understand how concerning that really is. So China has a very powerful economy, a growing military that is being significantly invested in, and probably the largest sovereign investment program in the history of the world via the Belt and Roads Initiative. They have signaled an interest in developing a central bank digital currency, a CBDC. And what that would look like is them running their own centralized digital currency that allows them to totally surveil all economic activity within any sphere of influence that they have. So let's talk a little bit about what that might imply. But it would certainly imply that if you were performing activity that was not palpable to the Communist Party, that it could be shut down, it could be coerced, it could be stolen, the value, the wealth, all of that. You also have total optics into the national supply chain of all precious resources and retail and industrial use. So You're talking about a massive operation on a financial surveillance perspective. The concerning part, I think, from a Western perspective, potentially, is that in the past, if we wanted to sanction activity because we were concerned about a geopolitical implication of some initiative, let's say expansion into Crimea, or foreign direct investment in Africa, you could use the traditional financial system to put people on the Office of Foreign Asset Control list. You can sanction nations. You can prevent flow of funds via the traditional financial system. And in doing so, in combination with the patrolling of the oceans via a large naval capability, you can broadly keep lanes of commerce open and you can set some of your own rules of economic activity. Regardless of where you stand on that, the new world is a bit different. If China decides it wants to sell, let's say, aircraft jets to, I don't know, Iran, and we go, well, they're a sanctioned nation, you shouldn't be able to do that, China will just say, well, Iran's paying in central bank digital currency, and they're going to use Dragon Coin to do so, and there's no way you can prevent that transaction from happening. And if two countries decide to use that currency to perform that trade, then that's it. The trade happens and the United States loses its ability in cooperation with its allies to police that type of technology transfer. And so the Chinese have absolutely zero reason not to do this, which is why they're doing it. And so what is the response to that? Well, I think it's a really interesting one because now we have a real threat to dollar hegemony and in alongside that allied geopolitical response to expansion of adversarial activity. In response, I think the only answer is to build a better form of money. Build a better form of money and embrace innovation in a way that people voluntarily accept, adopt, and use it. And we have traditionally relied on our open model of mobility and freedom of expression and freedom of religion to attract and retain the world's most capable and talented people and allow human expression and creativity to flourish, which creates better outcomes. And I think that is still the type of society that I want to live in and invest in. I think that digital currencies, ones that are permissionless, ones that don't care about the circumstances of your birth, that put everybody on the same starting line, at least to begin with, are a really powerful tool for human freedom. And I am excited about basically using those tools to build a world that enables more human freedom. So in short, when we try and grip too hard, or we try and regulate too much, or we try and clamp down human freedoms, we tend to have very, very sad, very adverse outcomes. So I think the best way to fight a closed system is to embrace the things that, one, historically have made us more powerful, but are also just the right thing to do for humans.
So that is, I think, very well expressed. But the related point, and I was talking to a friend of mine called Rob Rooney, who's a very senior figure at Morgan Stanley, and he said that for 95% plus of the 7 billion people on this planet who don't care or have the luxury to debate the evils of fiat currency, they want to live their lives, have jobs, buy stuff. But for that, they want trusted central authorities. And how do you reconcile the need for trusted central authorities with the proliferation of these digital currencies?
In some ways, these digital currencies are a response to those trusted central authorities, but in the opposite way, which is we're not sure we can trust them. We can't trust them not to debase our currencies. We're not sure if they're actually capable of managing our policy responses to modern threats. These modern threats require global coordination, global cooperation on everything from climate change to national security issues, to combating terrorism, to combating radical ideology. And as an heir myself to an economy that basically put me into a workforce that was very crippled in 2008, I'm 36 years old. And so far, we've had two hugely calamitous economic events just in the first 15 years of my career. And I'm not complaining in comparison to other historical tragedies, but I'm making the point that it's not clear to me that our institutions are actually doing an extraordinary job in managing that sacred trust that we place in them. And so we, Simon, have accepted in our Western democratic societies that there's a good reason to separate church from state. So that if you decide you want to worship God, you should be able to do so. And if I decide I want to worship some other religion, that's acceptable and it should be tolerable and we should respect each other's freedom to do so. We also have freedom of assembly and freedom of speech so that we can discuss controversial ideas. If I want to go maybe seek advisement from a mental health professional, I should be able to do that. I should be able to pay that mental health professional for that advisement and not have to worry about my Facebook feed being filled with self-help books and don't kill yourself guides the next day, because that transaction relies on privacy. And I think it's reasonable that in the modern and new era that we really embrace digital privacy, and especially financial privacy, in an era where the separation of speech from state we've recognized to be valuable. We've recognized the importance of religion from state. And maybe it's important to recognize the separation of money from state. If the state continues to constantly increase the total supply of money and fund whatever the zeitgeist is for the current political party, whether that's in the United States funding large infrastructure bills, funding large invasions in the Middle East, or large walls in the southern border, these things are easy to sell potentially politically, but disastrous to finance economically. And so I would argue we continue to witness in the long term centralized systems basically corrupting themselves. And that to me is a severe threat to human prosperity. And so decentralized systems basically are all about trustless coordination, and basically people participate in them without any coercion. And it's just voluntary transacting. So if you and I want to engage in business, we should be able to do so in a peaceful way and use systems of technological transfer that enable us to do so. I do think that there are very good reasons why we have organized our world with political power and religious power and other things. And all these things need to be managed in a marketplace of ideas. And enabling that marketplace of ideas to compete is really one of the beautiful things that we embrace.
The elephant in the room before we leave crypto and blockchain is that Bitcoin specifically doesn't come out of nowhere. It's mined by solving large complex mathematical equations, and the computers that solve them need large amounts of electricity. We're in a world where the sensitivity about climate impact is obviously growing. Is it just Bitcoin for whom that is a real problem, or is this a much bigger problem?
The Bitcoin network consumes an extraordinary amount of energy to run a computational network known as the blockchain. In order to maintain that, these Bitcoin nodes basically run constantly to keep a copy of the network updated. Now, it's been a very valid criticism brought by both institutions and more recently the environmental social governance requirements of institutions to study this very carefully. It's a very valid criticism of Bitcoin specifically. Now, there's two or three things to understand about this. One, almost all of the Bitcoin mining is now moving into jurisdictions with very low energy and renewable energy environments. And this is because if you want to operate a high margin mining operation, you want to have very low cost of energy. And so ironically, even though it is consuming a lot of energy, it is actually financing some of the largest renewable energy investments in the world today. So we have this interesting dynamic where even though it is consuming a lot of energy, it's actually driving investment in renewables in the first place. However, if you don't like this and you think that the energy consumption is concerning to you, that's okay. There are cryptocurrencies that do not mine the way Bitcoin does. So there's proof of work systems, and then there's proof of stake systems. The Ethereum protocol is currently undergoing a major upgrade to switch over to a proof of stake system. These require far less energy consumption. It's quite likely that many of these alternative energy consumptive cryptocurrencies will inspire innovation and investment from some of these ESG mandates because of their designs. Long story short, you can align your personal values with digital assets and digital currencies that fit your worldview. Bitcoin is digital gold. Gold, by the way, also terrible for the environment, requires strip mining, complicated industrial processes, dangerous chemicals to extract out of the Earth's crust. Bitcoin is frequently referred to as digital gold. It requires a lot of energy too. If you don't like either of those, that's okay. But there are some reasons why energy being transferred and stored as a store of value into something also has economic value.
So, three cryptocurrencies on a 10-year view, which would you own?
Well, I should preface this by saying I'm not allowed to provide investment advice and people should do their own research. But There's a good reason why Bitcoin has been successful and the reason why it has so much market share today. It has been battle tested and it is extraordinarily resilient to a variety of different attack surfaces. And it's also proven out to be quite useful in the era of the economy shifting into a digitally first economic coordination system. So I like Bitcoin still. I like Ethereum a lot. I think there's an enormous community of very clever programmers, developers, and entrepreneurs that are thinking really way further afield in terms of how we can build resilient computer systems in agreements that actually run software in a distributed way. So imagine a social network, again, that rewards its content creators. Imagine agreements that are vastly more complicated, taking in variables and then executing agreements. You could run distributed autonomous organizations, aka corporations, over one of these networks. So the Ethereum protocol is particularly cool. And then there are these, what we would describe as intermediary protocols that live between these. Protocols like Polkadot are pretty interesting. So again, I would highly advise anyone who's interested in these capabilities to listen to podcasts like Simon, do some of your own research, read the investment theses from places like ARK Invest. They are doing some really good research on these different asset classes. And then have a long-term view. I don't think a lot of the playing field will be determined in the next year. This is going to take a while to bake in. And we're on a long-term journey of transitioning our financial system into one that matches a digitally native world.
So I want to just close with a few different questions. You are involved in a charity called Sky's the Limit, which I believe is helping digital mentoring. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing there.
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. So besides trying to help anyone in the world better have access to managing their wealth by building software that helps them send, receive, secure, trade, and exchange their money, I also care a lot about entrepreneurship. And in 2014, I started a charitable organization called skiesthelimit.org. And we focus first by helping entrepreneurs get mentorship and advisement. And I think if you talk to almost any entrepreneur or even many professionals, navigating your life, your career, or your business requires a tribe. And you need to have people that can help lift you up, that can help you see your blind spots and be a good board of advisors to you as you mature through your story arc. And so we built skieslimit.org as essentially an online venue where first-time entrepreneurs can safely practice building businesses. And we focus specifically on helping underrepresented entrepreneurs. So we've had 45,000 people sign up, 80% are people of color, 70% are women, and 58% are Black women. Now, most of the entrepreneurs we work with have never started a business before. So there may be thinking, how do I use the things I have around me to practice building my first business? That might be maybe running a small catering company out of their kitchen or building a clothing line or starting maybe a hair salon or something like that. Now, all these small businesses need to become tooled with digital capabilities, whether that's having a website or learning how to do influencer marketing and those types of things. So at skieslimit.org, they can sign up. We match them with volunteers that we're always recruiting. So I'm sure there would be plenty of fantastic potential candidates to help support these young entrepreneurs that are listening to the podcast today. All of you hold significant amounts of social capital. And we got that social capital primarily through the circumstances of our birth. We were lucky. We went to school, went to business schools, we worked in great companies, and we learned a lot about how to conduct business. I think that by transferring some of that social capital from those that have it to those that need it, we can build a more diverse, more resilient, and greater ecology of wealth creators. And that's super important. The economy today is incredibly fragile. The pandemic and the lockdowns crushed small businesses, especially. We're going to have to phoenix new types of businesses, new types of companies that can clothe and feed us. And we also need to help people practice. It on average takes entrepreneurs 7 times to try and fail before they get a business that runs. That is okay. You have to start somewhere. And so it's skieslimit.org. You can sign up. It's free. We have mentorship and advisement, a pathway to business ownership, which is a curriculum. And we also offer grants to entrepreneurs anywhere in the world. Just recently launched in the UK, which I'm extremely proud of. So we now have reciprocity between the US and the UK as an international non-governmental organization.
Well done, you. We'll be including in the show release the links to that as well for people who want to know more about it. You sent me an article on capital cities, and you've just opened a new office in London. Post-Brexit, there's been lots of talk about London's demise. I don't happen to subscribe to that, but why did you vote for London and what do you think's going on?
Look, London has been a home for financial innovation and business innovation for thousands of years. And there are a couple advantages that the UK has, regardless of the historical turbulence and political turbulence of the past few years. It's an incredible time zone. The language that is spoken here, the National Health Service, as a defense against pandemic risk, is actually a significant asset to the country. And then also, you have a property rights system and a rule of law that is baked in, that is incorruptible in many ways. And so I think you've got a very strong core set of variables that make the UK a great place to build companies still. At the end of the day, in the digital context, we're going to be expanding globally. We've also announced an opening of a US headquarters in Miami. We're very excited about serving North America from that venue. It gives us access to Latin America as well as North America in a very great time zone. I think the big cities of yesteryear, though, do need to be competitive in attracting talent and making sure that those jurisdictions are the best place for entrepreneurs to come to create great companies and share that wealth with their shareholders, their employees, and their communities. And so in the long term, I'm also bullish for the UK. It needs to navigate this transition out of the EU and make sure that it's the best place in Europe for entrepreneurs to build companies. And if they do that, the talent will come. The other thing that's important about the UK really is its commitment to providing a national health service. This is a big deal in the era of pandemics. The rollout of the vaccine in the UK has far exceeded those of other industrialized Western nations. If the country can stay healthy, it can get back to work, it can cooperate, people can convene, you can get creative, you can build great, great tools and services. So that's my little pitch for the UK as well. I'm not as doom and gloom as other folks, but I do think the composition of what a company looks like and its sort of needs has changed. Makes more sense to me to invest in high-speed internet than building open floor business plans. And so even though there's a lot of open commercial real estate in London today, there's also a lot of need for access to affordable homeownership in London, and we can navigate adjusting the composition of the real estate portfolios.
So Nick, you're meeting some very interesting people, particularly those who have invested in your companies who go along the way. Who haven't you met yet that you'd really like to talk to?
Man, Simon, that's a great question. You know, I have been very lucky to meet a significant number of idols of business leaders that I respected, but also contemporaries and colleagues over my career so far. So I get a lot of joy of meeting the young people that are building companies in this space that have the energy and ambition to do the next big thing. I'm not looking so much at existing role models anymore, and I'm more looking at the young adults that see things in a way that it's kind of hard to explain, but like you've got some children today, you watch them interface with new tools and they adopt things so quickly. And it's inspirational to me to spend time with young entrepreneurs that are cutting through what took me decades to figure out, they're picking up so much faster. And so I met with a young entrepreneur 2 weeks ago that had an idea for building essentially a social financial system. And I'd never thought about how something like that could work before. And I thought that was pretty inspirational. Actually, I mean, this is going to sound silly, but I'm reading this book right now called The Ministry for the Future. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it's probably been provoking some of the more sort of unusual creative thinking I've had recently. So I think if I could have lunch with Kim, I'd really enjoy doing that right now.
Nick, you're very busy. You're doing lots of things. When you are not doing those things, what's your perfect day?
My perfect day would be waking up, watching the sunrise, having a nice cup of coffee. I'm somewhere out in the wilderness. I get up and fish. I love fly fishing. That's a personal hobby and passion of mine. I'd have my closest friends and family members around, my two dogs, and we'd probably be camping. At the end of the day, we'd tell stories and watch the stars and have a nice evening. That would probably be my perfect day.
I'm going to introduce you to Robert Smith, who was our podcast guest a couple of weeks ago, who runs Vista Equity Partners, because he loves to fly fish. So there you go. As I thought about this whole area, I sort of wrote down three things, and I'm going to have to reflect on them afterwards. But one is what we do have in blockchain is a technology that changes information recording and sharing in ways known and probably not yet known, but it's very powerful. Number two is that what we don't have through cryptos is a collection of currencies in the properly or maybe previously understood classification of currencies that can be used for easy exchange and convertibility. And what we might have is an emerging store of value in the digital real asset space. But I'm an old-time value investor, and that's dangerous. So first of all, I'm going to let our audience think, decide, and listen. But Nick, the final words are yours.
Your summary of those is probably accurate, although I've crystallized those and I don't see them so much as an unknown as so much as I think they've actually come to fruition. So depending on where you are with that historical perspective, we're coming at it actually relatively in synchronicity. So important takeaways. Humans have been improving money since the dawn of time. Like I mentioned, we tried seashells, we tried feathers, we tried gold coins, we tried fiat money. And in the era where the world is becoming increasingly digital, it seems that potentially digital currency or cryptocurrencies that rely on digitally native characteristics could be the next evolution of money. That evolution would borrow from previously useful and valuable concepts that we can relate to, whether that's gold and the properties that it possesses, marrying those with cash capabilities, and then giving them digital features so that we can do all the things we need to in the era of the internet. Story one. Story two is, are there emergent forms of money that are different than our historical analogies for them? And I think that is true. Our understanding of value is changing a lot. So are the types of things that people want to do with their time. If you were to survey young adults in the 1940s or 50s and you asked them what they wanted to do in their careers, you heard things like be a doctor, be a banker, be a teacher. If you look at what they want to do now, it's a little different. They want to be a podcaster, a vlogger, or a influencer. So Simon, you're leading the charge here. How they get their wealth and interpret their understanding of value, whether that's through followers or the amount of attention that they can gather and driving that attention into different topics, super interesting. And the last piece is, I think we have a duty to reimagine the world and hopefully make it a better place than the one we inherited. And so that's constantly challenging our assumptions about what's best and how to make it a little bit better. And so I love the work I get to do with my colleagues on a day-to-day basis. It's super interesting. It's drawing talent from all of the best firms in the world. And a small plug for the company, we now have more open roles at blockchain.com than at any point in the company's history. If anything that I described today sounded interesting, we are looking for people to help us shape these outcomes and ultimately leave this world in a better state than we inherited it. So thank you very much for your time and the opportunity to talk about what we're seeing happen in the digital currency space. The summary is, we now have a technological capability that allows us to record a state of any type of transactional history and keep that state in a state of perpetuity. And so you have an immutable record-keeping system, a digital property rights fabric, and a global transactional system all baked into one network. And all those things now are being more and more adopted by people. And when things are useful and they have general scarcity applied to them, they command market prices. And thus you have things like Bitcoin and Ethereum and a variety of other digital currencies.
Thank you. This has been a terrific, detailed, long conversation. And I'm sure many of our listeners, a lot of our listeners, will find it very enlightening. We're at the foothills of a big transition. So thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you, Simon. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.